back to Media Monarchy. My name is James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster, and this is our second installment of our new geopolitics series, and we are happy to have on the line activist and journalist Eva Bartlett of In Gaza. Eva, thank you so much for coming on the line.
It's my pleasure, James. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So you are on a speaking tour as we speak, and I believe you're in New Jersey right now?
Yeah, I'm actually in New York City right now.
Oh, wow.
Staying in New Jersey, but I came to coincidentally, a screening of a Palestinian documentary called Five Broken Cameras at the UN. So I've just been watching that, and we'll be continuing on to Philadelphia and D.C. and so on. It's all listed on my blog.
Okay, and we can get into that, and of course, everything that we mentioned will be included in links in the show notes of this episode. But Eva Bartlett, let's just give folks maybe a little bit of background of yourself and the work that you've been doing over these last few years in Gaza.
Sure. I was born in the States, in Michigan. I grew up in Canada, completely apolitical and apolitical family. And it was only about in 2005 when I first heard of Palestine. And just to make a long and somewhat boring story short, I just went from being completely ignorant on the topic to suddenly finding out a lot of information that was very disturbing about Palestine. And it gripped me. So I learned as much as I could and decided that I would try to go over to Palestine and witness what was happening at the hands of the Israeli army and the colonists there. In my research, I came across the International Solidarity Movement, which is a nonviolent activist group that witnesses the worst of the crimes perpetrated by the Israeli army and the colonists, and document and then share it by writing, by YouTube, and also by doing speaking tours like the one I'm embarking on right now. So I went to Palestine in 2007 for 8 months in various areas of the occupied West Bank. Seeing, maybe get into in a few minutes exactly what kind of work we were doing there, but eventually I was deported and banned from returning. However, I did, in 2008, I was able to sail with the Free Gaza Movement from Cyprus to the Gaza Strip, which is also part of Palestine. And the reason they were sailing is because Gaza is under a blockade or siege, and the sea was the only way that people could actually enter Gaza. And even that has been since then limited. And there's absolutely no access into Gaza unless the Israeli authorities or the complicit Egyptian authorities allow you to enter or to exit. So fortunately, I was in Gaza from November 2008 till June 2010. And then over the years since then, I've gone back to Gaza and continued to document various things to do with farming and fishing and the siege and Israeli aggressions on Gaza.
So can we just kind of lay out for folks what the basic conflict is there? Just to again kind of put that on the record for folks so they know who the PLO is, who Israel is, who Hamas is.
Sure. And when you say conflict, do you mean from 1948 or are you... would you like a lot of history?
Well, that's kind of. That's I guess what shows how actually complicated and how long this has been going on. Let's keep it more current, I suppose.
Okay, so with regards to Gaza, it was occupied both militarily and with colonists until 2005. At which time the Israeli authorities pulled the colonists. There were roughly 8,000. In Gaza. And of course, as with any sort of colonies, they had the best land, they had control of the water, etc. So they were evacuated from Gaza in 2005. And then the narrative since then has been, well, since we pulled the colonists out, we no longer occupy Gaza. But in fact, the Israeli army still controls Gaza, all the entry points except for the Egyptian-controlled Rafah crossing. And they do still militarily occupy Gaza, including waging regular incursions into the border regions on a weekly basis, and of course patrolling Gaza's skies with F-16s and with drones, and patrolling Gaza's waters with gunboats. And with all of these weapons of war, they fire upon Palestinian farmers and fishers and civilians in the border regions, and of course they randomly wage wars on Gaza. Their narrative would be that they're trying to defend themselves and stop rockets from Gaza into Israel. But in fact, when you compare, first of all, the huge amount of weaponry that Israel possesses, I think most people who know anything about Israel or Palestine know that Israel in the Middle East is one of the strongest and well-equipped armies in that region, of course, getting billions of dollars from the U.S. every year. And conversely, Palestinians have nothing. They have no tanks or warships, etc. They have very simple, you know, machine guns, which are, of course, for resistance against the Israeli army. And there are some very crude rockets that Hamas, which is the political party in power in Gaza, and other resistance have crafted. But these rockets are not guided. They're small. They're largely ineffective. And it's not for me as a non-Palestinian to say in which way they can choose to resist the military occupation of their land, but it isn't very effective. I mean, it's certainly, when you compare the gruesome statistics, and every life is important, but when you compare the statistics of Palestinians maimed or killed by Israeli army or settlers, the statistics just don't compare. It's like something like 100 to 1 or even more than that. Every Israeli life, 100 Palestinian lives must be taken. I believe it's actually more than that. So the issue is that Israel does control Gaza militarily, has blocked off the borders to export completely. This is devastating the economy. Only allows certain things into the strip and does not allow construction materials. So all of this compounds the dire situation, the manufactured crisis that Gaza is under right now, because if the borders were open, there would be less unemployment because there would be trade. And if the borders were open to imports, including construction materials, Palestinians could rebuild their homes, could rebuild the schools Israel has bombed, and the hospitals that Israel has destroyed or damaged, and they could expand on their sewage holding pool, alleviate the sanitation crisis. So it is one kind of layer of misery on top of another. And I do believe there are certain things that will require more work to repair, like the aquifer is close to implosion. The UN produced a report saying that by 2016, if no action is taken now, the aquifer will be irreversibly damaged and by 2020 completely unusable. And this is the sole source of fresh water in the Gaza Strip. So that is obviously a more difficult issue to fix. It will take years and years to even moderately repair the aquifer or help replenish the aquifer, but other things like the sanitation and waste crisis and the electricity crisis could be fixed immediately if the Israelis were willing to. So this is just one aspect of it. You asked about Hamas. So they were elected in 2006 in free and fair elections, supervised by international bodies. But I suppose the West did not expect Hamas to win. They preferred that Fatah, which is the other main political party, and unfortunately, which under the current leadership of Mahmoud Abbas, is certainly corrupt. And I think that Western players, including Israel as well, we're hoping that Fatah would win and therefore would be like a puppet government. The people did elect Hamas, and the West didn't like that, so immediately cut ties with the government in Gaza. And that was the first kind of political stage of imposing a siege on Gaza.
And we've been kind of having that situation for now nearly 7 years. So as I look at the news even right now, some of the things that you're speaking of, I can see 10 hours ago from the Ma'an news agency, Israeli warships open fire at Gaza fishermen.
Yes.
And so those are the kinds of things that happen all the time. And you were sort of speaking at it as a way to sort of inform us. And I look and here it is today.
Yeah, it's again, if you're not looking for it, if you're not checking out either local Palestinian or other Arab nation news, or, you know, alternative news sites or activist news sites or Palestinian bloggers or journalists, if you're not actually seeking that, then you won't hear about it. And I think that's respect to the speaking tour I'm working on. That's one thing I really want to drive home to the average person is this thing is happening. These types of crimes are happening every single day. So with the fishers, they're being restricted to less than 15% of the fishing water that they were accorded under Oslo. And even so, they're restricted by, of course, lethal enforcement at the hands of the Israeli Navy. But even within these 3 miles, the Israeli Navy will come into that limited area that they've graciously allowed the Palestinian fishers to access, and they'll come within that 3 mile limit and they'll attack the fishers. Clearly a policy of harassment and basically an attack on all means of being self-sufficient. I met somebody yesterday, this is an aside, but we were having a little discussion, and at points I mentioned the severe restrictions on goods coming into Gaza and the fact that people are 80% dependent, like the 1.7 million people that live in Gaza, 80% of the population is dependent on food aid, and that itself is inadequate. It doesn't even include produce or proteins. And he said, well, why don't they just grow their own food? And I said, that's the point. They do grow their own food, but the Israeli army prevents farmers from accessing one-third of agricultural land in Gaza, and they do so by shooting at them, by shelling them, by abducting them, and by destroying their land. And the Israeli Navy prevents fishers from accessing the water. So it's nice to say, why don't they grow their own food, and they certainly do want to, but they're being prevented from doing so.
Now, you also mentioned Egypt, and again, as we look in the news right now, we see Gaza Strip faces ferocious blockade after Egyptian closure of Rafah border crossing. How does Egypt also play into this?
Well, so Egypt, after Israel, is the second largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid. So I think that's a not an insignificant factor. I think that's a pretty critical factor. Also, in July, I believe it was, of 2013, was a military coup, and basically, whereas they had elected in their so-called revolution the year prior, they had elected a representative, the first time they've had actual elections in decades, as I understand. There was a military coup last year, and now the Egyptian military regime is back in place. And this is important for various reasons, because they have interest and working with what the Israelis and the U.S. want. So that is locking down Gaza. They have financial interests. They also have deals with Israel. They sell Israel natural gas. And the Egyptian military is a business in itself. I mean, they control a lot of the industry within Egypt. So it's good for them to be in power because they can line their own pockets. So what they've been doing to Gaza is basically there were hundreds of tunnels. Some estimates put the tunnels at more than 1,000, leading from Egypt to Gaza. And these were what most people would call the lifeline, because these tunnels were bringing in every single thing that Israel was denying Palestinians, including the very basics of life, like baby formula or diapers or livestock or fertilizers, etc. All these things were being denied Palestinians to Gaza, so they were bringing them in through the tunnels. And they were even exporting things like tomatoes to Egypt, because they aren't allowed to export via the conventional means. So, unfortunately, the Egyptian military has destroyed, by most accounts I've read, virtually all the tunnels, which is putting a huge strangle on the Palestinians in Gaza, because now not only can they not import all those goods, but they can't import the industrial diesel that they formerly were buying from Egypt. And this diesel, of course, was used for vehicles, but also more critically for the power plant. So now the power plant itself was bombed by the Israeli army in 2006. Was never fully rehabilitated simply because the Palestinians weren't allowed to bring in the proper parts to rehabilitate the plant. And then on top of that, now they not only is the plant not tip-top state, but it doesn't have the necessary fuel to run. So then this affects the electricity crisis. It's funny, in North America, if we have a winter storm or for whatever reason we lose power for a few hours, people go berserk. But Palestinians have at best 6 or 8 hours of power a day. And this has been going on for years, these rolling blackouts. And to the point where in December, because of the fuel crisis, they were going entire days without electricity. And then, of course, this compounds on every other facet of life, including the sanitation and hospitals and education.
That it really is, as I think you describe it on your website, on ingaza.wordpress.com. It's a life under siege. Every angle, every rock, every hard place that you're kind of describing is, yeah, compounded by another rock and another hard place.
Yes, and I think I do try to stress that because, well, again, because there are people like you and I, and they're living under these absurd circumstances, impossible circumstances. And then it's not just, as the media reports it, it's not merely an economic siege, because that takes away the sting of what they're really enduring. Oh, economic siege, that's okay, but it is an economic siege that's allowed their exports. Many institutions have cut ties with Gaza, but, you know, prohibiting exports, prohibiting the vast majority of imports, and also prohibiting freedom of movement so that people can get treatment for medical care that they can't otherwise get in Gaza, or so that students who have places in universities abroad can actually leave. This is another critical issue with regards to the siege. And I remember a few years ago, there were, I believe, 8 students that had scholarships, Rhodes scholarships, I think they were, and they were not being allowed to leave. The Israelis weren't allowing them to leave, neither were the Egyptians. I think finally, because there was a media campaign done, of course, by grassroots activism, some of the students were able to leave, but many of them lost their places, their scholarships. And this kind of thing happens every year. So it's a siege also on the psyche, you know, taking away your hope. You can't get your, you can't further your education. You can't travel to see your family or people who come to see if they are even able to get into Gaza, but they happen to live elsewhere, often get stranded and can't leave Gaza. So it kind of works both ways. But in the end, the point is that they're under siege, under warfare on all fronts. And again, with the psychological warfare, I mean, the sound of numerous drones in the sky is really very difficult on the psyche, because you know what the drones are capable of. And their sounds are, it's like a train wreck in the sky, really. I mean, it messes with your mind. And they're up there all the time, and F-16s are flying over all the time. Sometimes they randomly release a sonic boom, which sounds like a real bombing, and other times they are real bombings, which again largely go unreported in the media. So, and I think also to do with the siege is that sense of isolation, because they're physically cut off from the world, and when the electricity is off for such long periods, then they're actually cut off from other means of communicating with the world. So it's truly a preventable crisis and a truly sadistic policy of all these cuts on the Palestinians in Gaza. It's really unacceptable. And were any other country in the world, I think that more politicians and more powers that be would speak out. But because it's Palestine and it's Israel imposing this, mum is the word, people don't really talk about it.
And that sounds like psychological warfare. And I think what you're kind of describing is, you know, not to say what, as you said, every life is important, but as you look at the news right now, the situation in Ukraine is massive 24/7 wall-to-wall coverage.
Yes. And, that's a good point. Yeah. And this warfare on Palestine, like I am focusing on Gaza, not because Gaza is more important than other parts of Palestine, but because it is more in the media blackout and subjected to more torture than other parts of Palestine. And it's been going on for so long, too. It's not just a flash, oh, this is something that's happened for 2 weeks. It's been, since 2006, the harshest elements, and even since the 90s, really, the closures on Gaza.
So are there, quote-unquote, peace talks coming up?
I've gotten so disenchanted with the whole notion of these peace talks that I'm not actually following it anymore. I know they have been in the past week or so meeting to discuss peace talks, but to be honest, I'm not sure where they're at right now. I believe that John Kerry is really trying to be the one that, you know, achieves some sort of peace talk. But as far as I know, every time he meets with Netanyahu basically announces the expansion of their colonies, their illegal colonies, you know, in occupied West Bank or Jerusalem. And basically Palestinians gain nothing from these peace talks. They're shoved to the table, because if they don't attend peace talks, then they will be called unwilling partners for peace. But they go to the peace table, and what is offered to them? A Swiss cheese West Bank, wherein the colonies annex the best areas, including, as I mentioned with Gaza previously, including areas, hilltops, areas where there's water sources. And then they have the Jewish-only roads that run to within the colonies and join them with Jerusalem and other cities in Israel. And these, of course, when I say Jewish-only, it means absolutely no Palestinians can drive on them. And then you have the separation wall that is this massive barrier, much larger than the Berlin Wall ever was, much longer, that snakes deeply into the West Bank and annexes even more land, stealing even more Palestinian land, even though they've already lost like 78% of their land to Israel.
So, hopefully the stunning irony of that isn't lost on folks, a wall bigger than the Berlin Wall.
Yeah, and on that note, there are a number of notable Jews of conscience, and including Jews who are Holocaust survivors, who have spoken out vehemently and said, this is worse than what we endured. What they're doing now is criminal, and they're doing it in our name, and, you know, they're ashamed that Israel is doing this, because they're saying, you know, I'm a Jew. For example, Hedy Epstein is a Holocaust survivor, and she's been very involved in Justice for Palestine. And there are many different, you know, there are some groups that just merely want to end the occupation of the West Bank and Jerusalem. And then there are other groups that go further and say, no, we want the right for all the Palestinian refugees who have been expelled off their land, ethnically cleansed, and their descendants to return. They have that right. And it's a right under international law. Various UN resolutions declare that right, but of course nobody actually enforces that. And that's the problem, is that nobody holds Israel accountable, and nobody enforces these legal resolutions, which should allow for Palestinians to return and for the colonies to be dismantled.
And again, if the shoe were on another foot and it were other countries breaking agreements and never coming to the table, it would be a completely different situation, I think.
Oh, totally. I mean, so I was in Gaza during, I refuse to call it the sadistic Operation Cast Lead, because Israel always chooses, like America does too, these horrible names for the massacres they wage on Palestine. But in 2008 and 9, I was there during the 23 days of bombing, and there were about six or seven other internationals with me throughout various parts of Gaza, and we were Palestinian medics and documenting the worst of these war crimes, so including the shooting of women and children and men point blank, you know, assassination style, or the herding of entire families into buildings, and this happened in a few different areas. And also, of course, the use of chemical weapons, including white phosphorus. So here's, again, the big hypocrisy. Israel, it's documented to have used white phosphorus in numerous areas of Gaza in 2008-9, and yet nothing's happened. There's been no punishment. But when it comes to Syria, there is no proof. There are unfounded accusations that the Syrian government used chemical weapons, and later it comes out that that the international observers that went to Syria to find out exactly if chemical weapons had been used and by whom, said actually the evidence points to the so-called rebels of having used it. But so nonetheless, the Syrian government is made to give up its chemical weapons supply, which it does, and it's in the process of getting rid of, based on unfounded and now proven untrue accusations. But when you have Israel, which is documented by all these same human rights groups to have used, without a question, chemical weapons repeatedly, nothing is done.
So I just looked up, back on February 2nd, RT reported, Israeli security minister slams Kerry over boycott threat, warns IDF may invade Gaza. So this idea that John Kerry's kind of acting tough.
Yeah, that's another aspect of this whole, when it comes to Israel. I mean, for example, they accused John Kerry, they accused Jimmy Carter of being anti-Semitic when he came out with his book, Peace Not Apartheid. They accused BBC of being pro-Palestinian, and anybody who's done a bit of research into the British Broadcasting Corporation knows exactly the opposite. It's an arm of propaganda for Britain, and it's heavily pro-Israeli. So yes, it's this whole thing, like, accusing everybody else of attacking Israel, when in fact it's pretty clear that Israel is the aggressor in all cases, and that when it comes to John Kerry or Obama or whoever happens to be negotiating with Israel, they're not asking for anything. They're really not asking for anything that's going to give Palestinians justice. And they might say, oh, we hope you stop building your colonies, but are they actually saying, we're not going to send you the billions of dollars a year in aid, and we're not going to, like, turn a blind eye whenever you massacre Palestinians. No, they're not doing anything like that. So this whole, you know, Netanyahu getting mad at John Kerry is just, I think, part of the ruse that makes people think that there's actually a peace process in play.
And I've said it a lot, and that's a whole other show, just documenting John Kerry's history of being a sort of ringer fixer, the guy the establishment brings in when the crap has hit the fan. But let's turn now to your speaking tour as we start to wrap this up, and if we can sort of turn it into a way of all the bad things that we've documented here to turn to, I think, the positive things that are going on and what you're seeing on your speaking tour.
Well, I'm just at the beginning of my speaking tour. So far, just on one event, I've organized it, so it took a bit of doing, and so there were a few days in which I had no events. I've done a number of radio and other interviews, but as of tomorrow, then I'll kick it off again, and we'll be going throughout D.C., New York, Austin, Buffalo, Colorado, California, Texas, and Chicago, and speaking in various venues, universities, community centers, churches. I think the nice thing is that, so I've only been involved in, you know, working for Justice for Palestinians since about 2006, really. So I don't have the kind of longevity, the scope of knowing, you know, seeing huge amounts of change as other people who have been involved in this for decades. But having spoken with people, the activists I'm meeting, et cetera, it does seem like there is change. Not that it's going to be tomorrow, or not that, you know, Gaza is not in a dire situation, because it is. But I think the change that people are seeing is that people are no longer just believing everything Israel says. They're now actually skeptical and actually being able to criticize Israel. And also people like myself and people who talk about justice for Palestine are becoming less afraid to actually speak out, because, I mean, the common tactic is to immediately say you're anti-Semitic. But now that word itself is losing value. People are saying, you know, you can't just slander everybody that criticizes the government's actions. This has nothing to do with criticizing Judaism. So I think it's good in that people are losing that fear to speak out, and that there's a genuine interest to hear more about Palestine. Like, again, for example, I just finished attending the screening of the documentary Five Broken Cameras. And with the exception of a couple of planted Zionists in the audience, people were very moved by the incredibly moving documentary. And this Palestinian filmmaker, I think he's touring the world and adding to, you know, awakening to people's awareness. So for myself, that's what I'm trying to do. I basically, in my tour, I present a number of photos systematically, you know, starting with agriculture, then fishing, then the seeds, et cetera. And I try to give people a sense of what it's really like in Gaza, what the human faces are, both in the dire circumstances when they're being attacked by all fronts, and also some of the good stuff too, their humanity and their resilience and their generosity, et cetera. And most people find it informative and are happy, you know, to have heard what I share. And I just feel like it's the least I can do, because I've spent considerable amounts of time in Palestine, and not everybody is able to go or to see. And so in that sense, I feel it's an obligation to try to speak out as much as I can. And hopefully people will feel like this is something that's important, and that they will become more informed and more involved.
As I'm looking over the itinerary, that looks like you're going to a lot of important places that will be great to kind of spread this message and get this dialogue going, whether that's Syracuse or MIT or George Washington University or American University. And you've also talked to my good friend James Corbett of Corbett Report. You've talked to Kevin Barrett of No Lies Radio, and you've also got interviews booked with the Real News Network and Bullet Points and some other things that are all on your itinerary list. We, of course, include in the show notes here. So, Eva Bartlett, any other closing words you want to leave for folks?
So if anybody is actually interested in interviewing me or has contacts with media, that would be wonderful. Again, the whole point is to keep Gaza out of the media blackout and bring the focus back to Gaza, and thereby hopefully effect some sort of change in the policies on Gaza. And otherwise, I just hope that people would on their own and continue learning about what they can do, how they can get involved, whether it's joining like a interfaith solidarity group or actually in Palestine. I'd highly encourage it if you have the time and ability to go to Palestine. It's a life-changing experience, and you'll meet some of the most amazing human beings in the most difficult circumstances, but it's certainly worthwhile doing. So other than that, I just hope that I see some large turnouts in the audience. And I appreciate everybody's support, and I really appreciate your support as well, and how you've taken to let me speak my piece here.
I thank you so much. I think you're doing amazing work. I think you're incredibly strong and brave and courageous, and I hope you'll stay safe.
So, it's too late for that, but thank you, James.
Eva Bartlett of In Gaza, I thank you so very much for coming on Media Monarchy.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure talking with you.